This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Though a ceasefire between Israelis and Palestinians is still in place, the decades-old conflict continues to erupt online. From hashtags praising Hitler to Facebook groups promising revenge on Hamas, social media is a hotbed of partisan vitriol. Could those hateful messages taking place far from Gaza be stoking Israeli-Palestinian tensions? Emily Shire is a reporter for the Daily Beast, and she examines this question in her article, Trolling the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Emily Shire, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with some examples of what kind of things are being said online and how widespread and how extreme.
Sure. Well, it really was widespread. That's what was disturbing to me when I began to investigate it, particularly when it came to bringing out levels of anti-Semitism, which definitely complicated things because, you know, the tie between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and kind of bringing up, often boiling down, anti-Semitic views in parts of the world is pretty strong. So, you know, Hitler was right. Hitler did nothing wrong were things that began to trend on Twitter and sometimes those regular civilians. But a lot of those pro-Hitler messages actually made it to higher levels of government in South Africa. A woman who worked for the African National Congress wasn't even suspended from her job when she posted a pro-Hitler, pro-Holocaust message on her Facebook. Mm. So it definitely was disturbing to see, I think to a certain degree, high government officials almost didn't take it that seriously because it is, it's Twitter, it's Facebook, it's, you know, these forms of social media we use really for recreational purposes. But it became widespread through these platforms.
You call it a parallel battleground taking place online. Right now, a ceasefire is holding. Is that reflected in social media?
I think it's reflected in that you don't see quite the same level of insightful messages. But that may also be more of a reflection in that a ceasefire is holding. This isn't in the news quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's probably what it's more of a bigger marker of. If people aren't discussing it, you know, on TV and other forms, then it's probably not going to be reflected quite as much in these social media platforms. But I will say the types of debate that you see on CNN and other, you know, cable news networks and, you know, in newspapers and different op-ed columns is very much at a different, much more mature and restrained level than what you see then explode online.
So you mentioned regular citizens, even some higher level government members in different places. How do we know who's posting these Hitler hashtags and, you know, the anti-Arab Facebook groups? Are they centered in the region, for starters?
On Facebook, we can know in that if you click on it, you can see, you know, where do they list as their location and assume that they're not lying. I can say this from the research I've done, it's from all over. It can be people in the United States. It could, you know, this was an example of someone in South Africa, people in the Middle East, people throughout Europe. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is an issue that globally many people, probably anyone remotely informed on the news, has an opinion on. It doesn't just affect the Middle East and it doesn't just affect the U.S. And anyone with an opinion on it is joining these groups.
Hmm. Well, you could even look at the hashtag ISIL or ISIS and not find such toxic exchanges. Why does the Israeli-Palestinian conflict spark such an emotional response and widespread across the globe?
I think because it's been lasting for so long and it's laden in so many heavy emotions. I think with ISIS, although, you know, we as Americans are debating how do we proceed, you know, strategically, we can all agree on the fact that they're a group, that's a terrorist organization that's doing horrible things. And those differences in, you know, how to move forward in our attack against them seem minimal compared to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that really draws strong emotions on both sides. And there's a lot of debate on how each side is painted. And that's been going on for decades. And it also goes back to a history of anti-Semitism, which is going on even longer, which complicates things. And it's just a lot of emotions to be dealing with. And there are a lot of emotions that then get boiled down into 140-character tweets.
Well, that's the question. You know, these messages get super focused, and people, of course, can remain anonymous. That's the nature of trolling. They can hide behind a handle. Do you have any sense of whether these posts reflect people's true sentiments or even numbers?
I don't think there's a way to fully tell that, you know, in terms of polling, because, look, if we polled you know, Americans and how they felt about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict wouldn't at all, you know, be on Twitter or on Facebook or using social media. I think the fact that you see this level of vitriol and it's not getting necessarily a strong response is that we've gotten used to these kind of comments. That's the scarier point to me, that this is changing the tenor of the debate. And so, you know, it's not insignificant numbers. These are not, you know, when something begins starting to trend on Twitter, it's something you should start paying attention to. It's no longer, you know, a fringe minority thought. But that being said, even if it's not, you know, you know, a huge portion, like 50% of all people on Twitter, the fact that we're kind of getting immune to these styles of comments is what's more disturbing to me.
Well, does this kind of hate speak on Twitter have any real-world consequences?
Oh, I absolutely think it does. I think it's this idea if you see something you've posted enough time on Facebook or you see a tweet enough time on Twitter, you get used to thinking that this is a normal thing. These hashtags, you know, Hitler was right, or you know, revenge groups on Facebook, these aren't normal ways for us to be having a debate. It escalates it to such an extreme, and yet we're getting used to these very extremist views. You know, we see it more and more, and it kind of soaks into the system, and it changes how we look at things.
Is there any debate really going on, any interaction between pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli groups, or is it just an echo chamber, you know, people looking for their own biases and confirming them?
I don't think there are good debates. I mean, I think you can go to these Facebook groups and see, you know, if someone posts something inflammatory, a lot of people will write comments back in response. So, yeah, that's debate to a certain degree, but I think it's very hard to change people's views without having an in-person discussion. And I think already if you're trying to argue against a very inflammatory view and that person stands by an inflammatory view, they're already in a state of mind where they're not necessarily open to debate and changing their thoughts.
Emily, in your article, you pick up on the role that Twitter played as instrumental in at least ushering or organizing the Arab Spring, you know, giving a voice to all sorts of people, letting them know where to gather. So what happened? Has Twitter lost that potential?
I think the frustrating thing is that Twitter had this great power to unite, and I don't think necessarily that power to unite the masses and to spread views in that regard is so necessarily different in its ability to spread views with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. With the Arab Spring, it was obviously, you know, for this certain kind of good and a sense of freedom that these people weren't alone in craving it, and it gave them, I think, a certain courage and power to unite. But at the same time, what we saw with that is it wasn't enough to sustain a movement, that it, you know, getting people excited about something isn't necessarily going to fuel all the logistics on the ground. And at the same time, a lot of these leaders in Arab countries began to see how powerful social media was, and then it's tough because when you see these new leaders come into power, they know how effective these forms of social media were, and at the end of the day, it's very tough to combat if they're going to shut it down.
Emily Shire, reporter for The Daily Beast, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now you'll find a link to read Emily's article, Trolling the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You may have heard that Amazon recently bought the online video platform Twitch for nearly $1 billion. So what the heck is Twitch? Up next, we're going to find out why Amazon dished out big bucks for a service that streams other people playing video games. That's after a quick break.